Let me introduce Ken and Helga. Ken's been a type 2 diabetic since 1999, qualified psychotherapist, hydrotherapist, executive coach, and a mentor. He specialises in emotional problems for people with long-term conditions such as, and the carers, such as diabetes, cancer, stress, anxiety, depression. He's also a type 2 diabetic peer support champion, and he's got his peer support group in Bromley in Kent. He's obviously he's an advocacy person too, helps people and companies understand what it's like to live with diabetes. He specializes in helping those with emotional problems and gives talk on emotional issues with for people that have type 2 diabetes. He's passionate about the ending the stigma surrounding diabetes, especially those people living with type 2. So that's Ken. Hello, Ken.
Hello. It's not just type 2. Type 1 as well. All types of diabetes, I try and help as much as possible in any way. I don't specifically, although it's probably more type 2.
Is that like a lot of us, we tend to kind of know our own conditions more than, you know, my experience of type 2 is my father was type 2, so, but I never felt as though, you know, the conditions were kind of, you know, were the conditions and were that similar in terms of my dad's experiences. So yeah, it's going to be a really interesting tonight for, you know, to have a type 2 kind of couple of guides, and so yeah, that's going to be that's going to be really interesting. Helga's a diabetes advocate and a wellbeing coach living in South Africa. She describes her most empowering day as the one when she disclosed her type 2 diabetes diagnosis to others, having hidden it for many years. Since then, she's not only found a voice for advocacy, but as a community of support too. She's got a special interest in type 2 patient integrated support and education. So again, welcome Helga, and that's it. I'll hand over to Kez now, because Kez is going to do the very famous, the very inaccurately called 90-second questions, which usually go on for about 15 minutes. So, over to you, mate.
Yeah, we've changed it out slightly this week. Normally, we'd ask some questions around kind of insulin use and hypos and hypers and things like that. But what I thought it would be really good to do, obviously Tony's given a brief kind of introduction about yourselves, but if we could find out a bit more about each of you, that would be really useful. I don't know who would like to go first. Either Ken, do you fancy going first?
Oh, always ladies first. Always ladies first.
Ah, brilliant.
Ken, you're so gracious. Thanks. Okay, so thanks for having me. And it was really interesting listening to the pre-conversation happening, and especially in terms of the dynamics around living with type 1 diabetes. You know, it's humbling listening to the conversation because, you know, as a type 2 diabetic, for me, I'm not insulin dependent, but I do take a long action. Like, I'm on Trulicity at the moment. And so, you know, I finger prick often, all the time. And although I've had the opportunity to use CGMs, for short periods of time as a tester, which is a game changer, I just can't afford it. And if I did, I think, you know, it would enhance and just support me in terms of, you know, better management. I mean, I discovered I was having a hypo sort of dipping under 3-2 in the night, you know, during sleep time, thinking it was hormonally related, but it is actually me having those in the middle of the night. And so I was able to adjust my oral medication accordingly. But if I hadn't had the CGM for those, for that short period of time, I wouldn't have known that. And it's just, it's one of the issues around accessibility and affordability around CGM specifically, and monitoring. So yeah, but a little bit about myself. I have been living with type 2 diabetes. Well, first I was just diagnosed way back in 2006 with gestational diabetes. And it was a fundamental turning point for me. I didn't speak about it. I mean, it literally was my health practitioners that knew about it, and my son's father at the time. And I kind of navigated the pregnancy with really not speaking about it. And, you know, I heard you mentioning about nutrition and exercise, and I ironically thought I was at the fittest and healthiest I was when I felt pregnant. And so when the diagnosis came, it was, I was totally shocked about it. And, you know, following that, I was also on insulin during the period, which happens during the third trimester of the pregnancy. And it was a very, very scary experience having to inject insulin and administer insulin to myself. And yeah, luckily for me, you know, my son was born healthy, but he was a big boy. He almost weighed 5 kilograms. I don't know what that exactly is in pounds, but he was hefty when he was born, and he was born by cesarean. And my diabetes dissipated after the birth, but statistically what had happened was that I couldn't beat the statistics, and I was literally diagnosed with type 2 diabetes 5 years later. And so, you know, for me, it's really been about needing to navigate it, including, you know, a bit of the conversation I was listening to Mark around weight loss, around the nutrition, around the balancing act, around how do I manage it, and, you know, a juggling act around being able to adjust my medication accordingly, as well as around exercise. And again, you know, a lot of what is part of my lived experience is that I never spoke about it. I literally only spoke about my diabetes for the first time publicly in 2017. And it was on World Diabetes Day at an endocrinologist. It was at a health forum, you know, with patients and health practitioners and specialists. It was a room of 100 people. And it's the first time I openly said, hi, I'm Helga, and I'm a type 2 diabetic. So
was there a reason for that, Helga? Was that a conscious decision or a guilt thing?
It was that, you know, I felt really ashamed. Although, you know, I was within the private healthcare system, and so although I had the best care, I just didn't feel, and I know it was, you know, the practitioners were all, the doctors were with good intentions, but nothing felt that my space was being held for me. It didn't feel supportive. So I didn't feel, I was being kind of fed going, well, this is what, you've got metabolic syndrome, you know, a geriatric mother. And, you know, let me qualify geriatric. Mm-hmm. I was in the 30s at the time, but that's what one is then defined as, yeah, at my age.
Yeah.
I was carrying extra weight, I suppose defined as obese at the time. And so what was happening for me, by all intents and purposes, if you look through the window and you looked at me and my life, everything seemed like it was really good and it was successful. And what I felt was that, you know, the narrative that surrounded me was about this glowing health around pregnancy and what it should look like and, you know, what you should be doing. And I thought I was doing everything I should be doing. And that came when I sat in front of the doctor getting the diagnosis, my gynecologist. I was just I felt ashamed. I felt that I let the team down. I let my baby down. I let myself down. And I felt that this is not something that I necessarily required support, because I needed to manage it because I got myself there. And so it was my responsibility to work on it, to get myself out of it. And remember, at that stage, my connectedness to diabetes was my grandmother, who had, they use like suiker ziekte, like sugar sickness. And so there was this monitoring of my gran and what she consumed. And it was all about not eating sugar, but there was nothing really informed about the experience. And then when I actually lived in London for a few years, it's almost like a second home. And I had a friend who was diagnosed at the time with type 1 diabetes. We literally went out for an evening out, as one does. We went pub hopping, and we came home and she collapsed. And it was a scary experience. And the next day she goes to the doctor. She comes back. She gets hospitalized. She comes back. And she comes back with a bag of insulin and a bag of candy bars and Coca-Cola. And she sits us all down. And she says, this is going in the fridge. Don't eat this. This happens to me. Administer this. And that was my first experience of type 1 diabetes. So, you know, to have come to fast forward when I felt pregnant and then got my diagnosis, you know, I wasn't educated. I had this limited experiences of what diabetes was. And it felt that it, because I needed to just self-manage it myself. And so with all the conversations I'd had over years and you know, what you see in the media and everything around it, it felt like I was totally and utterly responsible for my condition that I was in, and that I inflicted this on myself. And with that came a lot of shame and wanting to hide it, because I didn't want to be judged, and I didn't want to be discriminated, and I didn't want to be criticized, and I wanted to have a healthy baby. And so I decided that it was just easier and safer for me emotionally to just deal with it myself, you know. And in retrospect, you know, if then I knew what I know now around community and what was I actually did have access to, I think my experience would have been somewhat different. So, yeah, to answer your question, that was a long answer to Tony. Why I didn't speak about it was because of all those reasons.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that there will be some more conversations about that, and whether it's changed in your experience kind of as time's gone on around the stigma and those feelings and the input from the community. So that would be really interesting to pick up on that as well in a little while. But thank you for sharing that initially. And and Ken, are you able to tell us a bit about, having heard kind of what Helga said about your own journey?
My journey is probably slightly different from Helga's. I was diagnosed at the end of this month, 29th of March, 1999, to be precise, with type 2 diabetes. I got a phone call at 9 o'clock at night from my GP saying I had type 2 diabetes. Mainly because I'd gone with a whole lot of colds before that. But we'll skip the long story there. It's interesting to hear what people say. For the first 14 years or so, before I moved from Edinburgh down to Bromley, I didn't really do very much about diabetes. I just took my insulin, went to my endocrinologist in Edinburgh at the time, and just got on with life. It wasn't until I moved down here in Bromley, actually I'm in Bexley, I'm actually in the Foxbury ward for rehabilitation of it, just having had a knee operation. But I went to my GP, my local new GP, and she said, I'll be looking after your diabetes from now on. So I've gone from an endocrinologist to a GP. And then she left the practice and there was nobody in the practice. So I've gone from an endocrinologist, a GP, to nobody. So in 2013, 14, somewhere around over there, I can never remember the date exactly. I decided that there must be other people out there with type 2 diabetes, it was type 2 at the time, that must be in a similar situation. And maybe I'll start a peer support group. So I did on a Saturday morning, and about 20 people turned up, which I found amazing. And we've been meeting ever since, first Saturday of the month. The occasional hiccup now and again when I've been ill. But I found out that I was actually having to teach them things rather than me trying to get some support. Although I did get moral support, and I suppose, in a sense. So, and it is the shame and the stigma that's going around that really, I think, hurts. I think it, and it's not just from healthcare professionals or the media, it's from other types of diabetes. I mean, I even saw on a T-shirt that somebody was proudly sporting, "Yeah, I can't eat cake. I have type 1, learn about it." You know, you think, well, does that mean that all other 13 types of diabetes can't eat cake? And, you know, it was self-inflicted. So it kind of needs to be drawn out a little bit more than what it is. My peer support group now is, I don't care who you are, what you are, whether you're pre-diabetic, whether you're type 1, type 2, or any of the other types, you're welcome to come along and chat, listen, and say nothing if you want. And I do a hybrid thing. So people can't make it, they can still come along on, online. So to me, diabetes needs to be much more inclusive of all types rather than just separate. Because, I say it often, and I, as a psychologist or a psychotherapist even, I find it interesting that, oh, you've got to find your own tribe. Trouble with tribes is they fight one another, always trying to be one up on the other one. I think if we were one big tribe, we would be a huge influence, not only for ourselves, but politically as well. When you consider it, 537 million people at the last count have diabetes. So it's we really need to think of why we are like what we are. And I know there's certain biases. Like, yeah, I'll be a bias. I'll put my hand up to it, type two. But, you know, we need to work together. Sorry, I've gone off track. But
no, it's fine.
Not at all.
I wondered, like, even as you said, within the diabetes community as such, as a whole, is it still part of it still a lack of understanding?
Very much so. I mean, I spoke to quite a few people with type 1 and they didn't realise that there was something like 14 different types of diabetes. They thought there was only two. So it's, you know, I've got mine and I just have to learn about mine, which is fine. You need to know, understand yours, but understand others as well. Understand their pain. Understand their angst, their emotional problems and everything else. And I see, when I see things on social media and everything else, oh, eating disorders for type 1, mental health problems for type 1. So there's type 2 and all the other ones. Yeah. So think about what you're saying sometimes helps to, you know, helps everybody. It doesn't just help you, the one particular type. I'm sorry, I hate being negative with everything, but it's just if we don't tackle these negative problems, then the positive will never come through.
Yeah, definitely.
Do you think that's a psychological, a positive kind, you know, that lack of understanding. Do you think that's an intentional thing, or is it just that, you know, as individuals, with whatever type we have, our conditions, our treatments are similar, so we tend to gravitate towards our, if you like, our tribe naturally. And again, without my understanding of type two has only been through my, you know, my experiences through my father. If I wouldn't have had that, I wouldn't have known really anything. So what I'm saying is, do you think it's, you know, that there's an intentional kind of like grouping together, or that's just what happens?
It's because you feel safe. If you've stayed, you know, if you imagine football, we'll take a football as an example. You know, if you were, say, a Liverpool supporter walking in Manchester, would you really feel safe? And, you know, it's that sort of feeling that, you know, I'm safe in this group, so I don't have to worry about anybody else, which is fine. Yeah, you've got to look after your own self. But if what I'm trying to say is we're working together, I think most of the divisiveness, in a sense, comes from the healthcare profession itself and the media. You know, oh, you have type 1 diabetes. Okay, so you're on insulin. Yeah, we'll look after you better than, oh, you're on type 2. Oh, you'll be, because you're fat and you haven't exercised. And that needs to change. Really does need to change, because I'm on insulin. I have been for 25 years. And an MDI, and so I can understand. And where I learned all my information from, how on insulin and everything else, was listening to type ones.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, we have this in UK, and Helga knows this. We have the Desmond course, which only covers eating and exercise. Doesn't cover anything to do with insulin. Though I was at a conference last year with, and Simon Heller did say it was, there was a course coming out this year, but I will not hold my breath on that.
That just sounds like even to me, that just sounds like a massive gap.
Yeah, like, there's a huge gap. Yeah.
How can you? It's kind of like being told, "Here's some medication. Off you go. Work it out."
That's exactly how it is. You know, we have to try and find out ourselves and things. I mean, there are people that will say, "Oh, you're lucky because you can go into remission."
Mm.
Not everybody can go into remission. And remission is only a stopgap. It's not a cure. And that needs to be really emphasized. Although some people may think so, it is not a cure. It's just a way of managing your diabetes. That's all you've done, is manage your diabetes.
Aww.
I don't know what Helga thinks. I'll let Helga.
Yeah. No, I just... You know, since you both have touched on quite a few things, but I think the first thing is that, you know, I can speak. Obviously, I've had the privilege of now being connected to international community, being able to build capacity, you know, gain more experience, gain more knowledge as time has gone on over the last few years. But interestingly enough, and, you know, having discussions and webinars and speaking at various events, but in my experience, when someone is diagnosed, there is this pause, I think, that there isn't, as Ken was saying, you know, that emotional support that sits there. So this thing around, you know, we speak about psychological safety. And so when you're in a room with your practitioner, whomever that might be, endocrinologist or GP, etc., the business is about addressing the diabetes or looking and explaining to whichever degree your HbA1c, I always get that wrong. And there you're sitting with this number. So it's all about this number and how we're going to deal with this number. And then it's literally about the medication, your medication regime, the self-management. You need to go see a dietitian. But nobody explains to you what actually happens for you physically, biologically, what could potentially happen emotionally for you. And so you walk away with this, you know, the bag of medication, you're feeling quite vulnerable at the same time, and off you go. And I've had seen sort of newly diagnosed people living with type 2 diabetes who have either collapsed or have not had, don't have support, or don't literally understand what's going on. They literally walk away feeling very fearful and feeling very unsupported and not understanding their condition sufficiently because they've just been diagnosed. And there seems to be some kind of gap in between there. And that's the gap that I'm quite passionate about, is sort of prevention and just post-diagnosis, that there needs to be more support that sits in that space. So that's the one comment I wanted to make. I think the other comment I wanted to make is about discussion around type 1 and type 2 community being more integrated with one another. And the interesting thing was, I was on a podcast with one of my colleagues here in Cape Town, and the discussion was around, I said that, you know, sometimes I feel kind of that I should actually feel, you know, that I'm in a position where I'm not on insulin, I don't need to be as hypervigilant, and that, you know, someone with type 1 diabetes actually requires more of the attention and support. And so I've, you know, initially we had this debate about, you know, what is your state of mind and being an approach to being a type 1 versus a type 2? And do we approach it in the same way, or do we view that we can actually, we sit equally and equitably in the same space together? And I think that's literally about the ecosystem we come out of and how we actually view managing our diabetes and living with diabetes, whether it's type 1 or type 2. And I think that it's around creating spaces where we can have more discussions about our lived experiences and what that actually means to us and the impact on it. In the same way, while I was listening to the discussion before we started speaking, that the dynamics in terms of how Ken manages it, or I manage it, or Kez or Nats manage it, that manages our diabetes, is vastly different. And we can't get away from the fact, if one is taking insulin or not taking insulin, or in my case, I'm not taking insulin, that it does require more attention. One has to be deeply invested because it's part of our life. This is part of how we live. And so I think that there's an opportunity to create more spaces so that to work together in terms of whether that's advocacy or offering support in terms of understanding and providing education for both type 1s and type 2s in terms of what that lived experience is like. But it does feel sometimes that, you know, type 1 does get more attention and that it is a more cohesive community. I don't know if that would be the, Ken, if that would be the right word to use, but a cohesive community. I think that was the second thing. And the third thing is, in the South African context, I mean, one in every two people in South Africa go undiagnosed. So a large part of our population don't even know that they are living with diabetes or potentially living with diabetes. And so, you know, there needs to be a focus in terms of heightened awareness. So for me, prevention and awareness becomes really important. And so education and providing information is really important for the greater part of the community, because most of the South African population do not have access to private healthcare, as an example. They have to access the public healthcare system, which is already heavily burdened. And there's challenges, there's socioeconomic challenges in it, food scarcity issues. There are many issues that actually influence the dynamic around being diagnosed with diabetes. And so in terms of that, particularly early detection is really important, but it's about how to get to that space of early detection. And again, the kind of issues that are, that one grapples with in our context sometimes is really not as, it becomes an issue where community becomes really important, and it is an issue around what do we actually have to tackle first. So is it around creating more awareness, or is it around, for instance, speaking about things like creating more community mentorship and support in communities, or is it about everything? And so in terms of ecosystems, I just think that the ecosystem I come out of, and I'm very, very acutely aware of it, I've got access to private healthcare. I can sit and have this conversation and tell you that I've had access to CGM, and how amazing it would be if I had access to it all the time. But someone else who might be unemployed, has to access public healthcare, their lived experience is very, very vastly different to mine. They might be diagnosed, but won't be able to follow a particularly nutritional, structured eating plan or diet because they just can't afford it. And so their challenge would be in their ecosystem, would be around, so what is it that I can eat that's not carbohydrate dense, that's not going to actually have impact on my blood glucose levels, but I can't afford anything else more nutritional or a balanced diet. So sometimes I just think, you know, our context is really important in terms of the kind of conversations we have around, you know, how we manage living with diabetes or the lived experience, because it's very different, I think, for everybody, and particularly in the South African context, it's complicated in that it's about really accessibility and other challenges that, you know, are very basic, like I said, like things like nutrition. Sorry, I feel like I'm rambling.
No, I think it's a good point. Having listened to what you've both said, I don't really understand why there seems to be this kind of, well, this is from my limited understanding, blanket approach to kind of views on type 2 diabetes, whether that comes from health like professionals or kind of, you know, what we see in the media and things like that. And it does feel really disjointed. You know, there's constantly conversations about in the type 1 community about what works for one person isn't going to work for someone else necessarily. Mm-hmm. And I suppose it's, why doesn't that apply to anyone with diabetes of any description?
Yeah, I totally agree. Yes, you know, I think it's thing, and to pick up something that Helga said was when you go to the surgery or something and you're told that you have diabetes. What I said at one board meeting, local health board meeting that I belong to, what actually happens is that the person goes in and the doctor will say, oh, you have type 2 diabetes, here's metformin. Here's a diet sheet, here's an exercise sheet, and I'll see you in a year's time. Mentally, that person has thought, I'm cured. Mm. Why? Because when you go to a GP and you've got a sore throat or something, he gives you a pill or you know penicillin or something, and a week later you're cured. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's that analogy, that type of thinking that people go through nowadays because they're not aware of what's happening. And until something happens, you know, maybe starting to lose their eyesight, the kidney's starting to fail, the liver's doing something, or the heart's doing something, they will not take notice of the diabetes, especially people with type 2.
Yeah.
Liz, I do think, sorry, I heard someone else speaking, I interrupted.
No, carry on. Sorry.
I do think that cultural diversity is also something, another challenge in terms of the approach of how once someone is diagnosed, how they actually navigate that in their own home space with their family or whomever there is to support them. Because it is also the case where when you're in the public healthcare system that you have to schedule visits months, you know, you'll be diagnosed, you'll receive medication, you'll get the exercise and the health sheet, et cetera, and off you get sent for the most part. And when I speak about cultural diversity in terms of different cultures, there is an intersectionality in terms of how diabetes is viewed. I mean, these are not conversations that are had in terms of being able to take medication or what they are misnomers or misinformation about what it is to have diabetes. So, for instance, that it might cause impotency amongst men. And so, you know, in terms of culturally, in the Black culture, Black male is not necessarily going to be able to speak about it. I mean, you know, I had this conversation with one of the advocacies, a young African male that has found his voice for advocacy. He's a type 1 diabetic, and he was speaking about his peers and his community in terms of his passion is about speaking into his community around demystifying and having the correct information there and support there within the community to be able to speak about the facts around having type 1 diabetes, having type 2 diabetes, what the differences are. And so, you know, what Ken was saying about, you know, understanding, actually, you said most people don't know that there are so many types of diabetes out there. And I think when you're dealing with inclusion, diversity and inclusion within diabetes and creating community to and creating inclusion, I think it's important that we must acknowledge that there's well, certainly in our context, in South Africa, and I think within Africa, that there are so many various dynamics that impact on diabetes. It's not just a straight path. I think it's impacted by so many other issues, and it's complicated. It's complex. Yeah.
That's really interesting. I wouldn't have thought the cultural differences. I think to a lesser extent, you know, blokes generally as a whole don't tend to be that great at articulating things like emotional stuff. But certainly from a cultural point of view, I know that from my own experiences of you know, British stiff upper lip and stuff, it was, you know, that experience of people talking about, you know, particularly as blokes talking about their feelings and their fears and has not traditionally been a thing that people tended to do. And particularly, it's really interesting, Helgi, you talk about the cultural, you know, the cultural differences as well as the gender differences.
Yeah, well, as I said, it's like for me, that's why I use the word intersectionality, because it is about gender, it is about race, And certainly in South Africa, you know, we're a cultural melting pot in that. Let me give you an example. So statistically, research, when I sit in front of my doctor, she's showing me international research around my risk profile. So showing me Hispanic or, yeah, let's use that as an example in terms of where do I sit as close to, for instance, heart disease or prevalence of stroke, etc. And although statistically in South Africa, we have got statistics specific for South Africa, when I've been exposed to statistically what my risk profile is, I am looked at in terms of internationally what is out there in relation to my how I identify my race and my gender here in South Africa. And so, you know, in terms of, you know, attending conferences and looking at the data and the research that there is, my observation was that there needs to be more research in terms of African data, and specific in terms of how we are impacted. And so when it comes to things like race, you know, in our populations, Indian, what is referred to as colored individuals, I consider myself as a Black South African, but I'm a colored, statistically, if you look at the definition, I'm a colored female South African. And so my risk profile is high. Indian women's risk profile are high in terms of the South African context. And then men are second, you know, diabetes is considered as the number one, due to complications, is the number one killer in terms of mortality for women in South Africa. And I sit in that cluster of profile. And so I agree with you that when it comes to gender, women's health, there seems to be a focus on, but in terms of, you know, men's health particularly, again, there's an opportunity that I think needs to be spoken about more, particularly around both type 1 and type 2 diabetes and the impact of that, but in a positive. And I think that's what, for me, is missing, that I don't think we speak positively enough the language that we use and how we articulate living with diabetes, that it's not a sort of a end point. It's actually a starting point in terms of how we can regulate and adjust and change, and that we can live in a positive way with the condition. But yes, I agree that, you know, gender particularly, that there isn't, certainly from my context, there isn't really a focus particularly around men's health, and particularly diabetes. But I think it's because it's not, you know, it's not spoken about openly. I don't think it's spoken about enough, and it's not spoken about openly. And yeah, I suppose it is about men not necessarily articulating their emotions around having diabetes. I've got male friends with diabetes, and, you know, a couple who have contacted me one-on-one and said, you know, I'm doing this and can you help me out, etc. But it's not openly sort of, if you're going out for dinner or going to the pub for a drink, and, you know, it's not a conversation that you're going to have over a pint, you know.
It's just no. Well, and unless you go to a diabetes event, and yes. particularly, yeah. I think the diabetes chat team tend to speak very openly over several points every time we get together.
Yeah, I think the other thing I wanted to say was, my question is, why are tattoo people living with type 2 diabetes, where are they? Why are they not coming forward? And I think that's one of the things I'm working on at the moment, is what will make it feel like a turnkey and feel like it's okay to step in and join community or come and speak about it or lend your voice? Because not necessarily so much about the advocacy for me, as it is about knowing that there is the support available. So almost normalizing that it's okay, in the same way when someone is diagnosed with cancer, that it, there almost seems to be a normal, it's normalized in the way that there is support there, I can step in. It's okay for me to speak about it openly. It's okay for me to lean in. I know where to go. And it doesn't seem like it feels the same way for type 2. So my big question for myself is, so how do we navigate it to include and bring more people living with type 2 diabetes into community to join the conversation? Because to me, that's important, because the more people are talking about living with diabetes and their lived experiences will expand it and start creating a normality around being able to have these conversations that we're able to have and are really fortunate to have this evening.
Do you think that perhaps because type 2 tends to suffer more stigma, do you think that those communities aren't quite as strong and joined together because of the it's jokes and everything else that people tend to kind of feel stigmatized about? It's very difficult to get people to kind of, if you like, join a community without feeling as though they're having to, if you like yourself, Helga, like you did finally when you, if you like that word, that you, when you came out about your type 2. Do you think that maybe it's just the fear that
I'll be honest about it. You know, I was what was considered as morbidly obese at the time, and although I believed I was doing everything I could in terms of management, my well-being and my health, and felt that I was at the fittest, you know, it is what you're saying, that the storyline, the narrative, the experience around what diabetes looks like, and that it was, you know, self-inflicted sounds very melodramatic, but that you have managed yourself and put yourself and found yourself down the road towards type 2 diabetes of your own doing, that it is your own. So it felt like it was my fault that I had that I had created the situation. I created this diagnosis for myself, and I don't necessarily, and I think there are many people out there that feel that they put themselves in that position themselves. I know now that having type 2 diabetes is not my fault. You know, I had discovered my hereditary line around diabetes. And I've lost, you know, my journey has included the emotional support and dealing with it. My journey's included taking a focus on my physical health. So I've lost a lot of weight. I've lost 35 kilograms. I run, you know, I couldn't do that. I mean, before. And so I'm very active, I'm very physical, and it was interesting listening to managing when you are busy doing aerobic exercise or cardio exercise. It was interesting listening to the conversation in terms of insulin management with yourselves. And that was interesting because I spike initially when I exercise, but it's a long-term effect, but I normally have a very good week as a result of my
has Helga gone?
We've dropped out.
Okay. I'll pick up a little bit from her in the sense that I get the same question. Where are these type 2 people? Because, you know, let's face it, there's nearly 500 million people that behind. They're frightened to put their head above the parapet in case they get shot down. That you have the easy.
Yeah, I think that's what I was trying to you know, trying to get to. It does seem as though, particularly from what both of you have said, it's easy to make yourself a target, and I suppose that's what I was trying to, you know, that's what we're trying to find out, Ken.
Yeah, the other thing is that your type ones tend to go to endocrinologists, and you meet in the waiting room, and you all chat together sometimes. I've been there, done that one. Whereas we see a GP, and it's one at a time. You never know if the other people around you are people with diabetes, so you never have that communication. Also, the GPs and everything else won't really point you to peer support groups, you know, because they don't think it's necessary, or we're going to tell them about medication and all that sort of thing. And I keep asking GPs and nurses to come along to these meetings, and they don't turn up. You know, you think, why don't you learn about your diabetes? I'll give you a classic example. I'm here in this hospital, in this rehab facility. I gave a demonstration the other day to the nurses here on what the Freestyle Libre was about, how to put it on, because none of them have seen it before. None of them had heard about it really before. And this is a place where there was more than one person with diabetes.
Mm.
You know, and they're now trying to tell or look after us, in a sense, where we're actually having to be our own medics, in that sense. And that's not just type one, type two, it's type one as well.
Yeah.
I think, interestingly, I was thinking about what you said earlier about, Ken, about your group, anyone being able to turn up regardless of type. I'm in the same neck of the woods as you. And the accessibility for any form of peer support is shocking. And when it does come along, it's like it doesn't consider that people are working. It's like in the middle of a day, or it's 10 till 12.
Yeah, yeah.
Or, you know, and you're like, okay, that's great, but there's no kind of thought process.
No, that's why I did it on a Saturday afternoon or Saturday morning afternoon, so that you could, you know, if you could still have time for an early morning shop if you wanted to do it, or you had the afternoon off, you know. So there's always, and it's only an hour. I don't go on for hours and hours and hours. The other thing was that I'm on various panels for various trials, and one of them was trying to get people with type 2 diabetes, specifically type 2. I said, I asked them, this is European, so it's not just UK. I asked them, where were they looking at people?
Mm.
Guess where they were looking for them? In hospitals with people with type 2. I said, we don't go to hospitals with type 2 diabetes. We go to our local GP surgery, and that's throughout Europe.
Mm.
What they need to do is, as I said to a group, is Goya. Get off your ass and go to them. We need to go to where they are, not expect them to come to us. And if we don't do that, then there is nothing going to happen very easily. You know, we're not going to get that group feeling. We're not going to get that things going on, you know, that help everybody to understand. And as you said before, everybody's diabetes is different, but what you're doing might help me, because, you know, and several people's things, you know, as I said, I got it from people with type 1, understanding more about MDI, et cetera. And that is where I think it's a cross-pollination or cross-fertilization, as somebody used to say, that we can learn from one another. Because even nowadays, people with type 1 are having to use type 2 medication, or specifically used to be for type 2 diabetes. So we need that cross-fertilization for everybody to understand. I mean, I'm sure a lot of people with type 1 don't know that with certain metformins, it can really upset you and get sore stomachs and all sorts of things.
Yeah.
And there's two different types.
Yeah. So if we're thinking about kind of, what was I going to say? If you had to explain to someone what, I mean, we'll use type 1 as an example, or, you know, or LADA even, the difference between, say, type 1 and type 2, and what those symptoms might look like, how would you explain that to someone that has no idea at all?
How do I explain that? Well, I would explain that the pancreas, you know, I've been doing this for 25 years, not so much advocacy, but learning and everything else, is that type 1 is definitely where your pancreas has decided to go on holiday and will never come back again. Mm. And type 2 is where it goes on holiday some of the time and sometimes it doesn't. And it sort of works to a certain extent, but doesn't work. And as I said at one interview I did years ago, I said, I don't know if my pancreas has got up and left and gone on holiday because they don't test it again. You know? So it's... put it this way, it's not all about eating cake or eating sugar or carbs. Carbs is a way of managing diabetes, even for type 1.
Yeah.
And we need to get that message, change the narrative, the NHS, and everywhere, even worldwide. It's not just about carbs. It's about various other things. Because you can get type 2 with from open heart surgery, steroids, you know, lots of different ways. It's not just about people that are obese. And a lot of people that are obese don't have type 2 diabetes. You know, so it's the narrative needs to change, in my view.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I remember in my 20s, I was basically told you're type 2, and a bit like Helga was saying actually about the kind of the differences in age, you know, how you physically look, whether you're a male or female, that all kind of played into it. And I remember being told, you're very young for a type 2, aren't you, by a healthcare professional.
Yeah.
And then I was like, well, I'm just never going to talk to anyone about this ever, am I? Because that's the response that I got.
And there's children now, you know, with type 2.
Mm.
And where's their support? Where do you see anybody talking about type 2 in children? Yeah, they talk a lot about people with type 1, their children with type 1, but not anything about type 2. And I think we need, you know, it's for a long, long time, it's always just been type 1, type 2. And that's what people just thought that was all there is, really, in a sense. But there's a lot more to it than these things. And I know a lot of people who have LADA. I take it you have LADA? Or had LADA?
Yeah. Well, we're on the fence. I go with whatever's going at the time. Type 1, whatever.
Yeah. Because they were like, you know, especially in America, where because they're big people, they were told they were type 2, where in actual fact they were LADA, you know, until they got more tests done. And I think that sometimes, you know, we were talking maybe years ago that when things were starting to go haywire, well, not haywire, sorry, my brain's going, probably my sugar level's high, I can't tell you at the moment. But it's that sort of thinking that we need. People, we all need to be educated, all need to understand what's going on. If you say cancer, I have lung cancer, what does that conjure? You understand that, sort of. If I have bowel cancer, you understand what that means. Mm. Yeah? When we say we have diabetes, nobody understands.
No.
Yeah?
No. And see, you know, extending that to not just the understanding, but even if we're thinking worldwide access to medications, even, you know, if someone was to say that they were being refused cancer treatment, everyone would be horrified by that. But people who need insulin, that's completely different.
Yeah. Or even any other medication. I mean,
or any other medication.
Yeah, because a lot of people think, oh, yeah, it's all about insulin. It's not all about insulin, because even people that are not on insulin can die quite quickly as well. You know, they'll end up having DKA as well. So it's not as if it's purely about insulin. It needs to be about people that have that need diabetic medication, need to have that medication somehow or other. And I'm all for insulin for all, etc., blah, blah, blah. But it's too narrow a field for me to think about it in a sense. And it's almost as if, well, we can neglect everybody else, but as long as the type 1s get their insulin, it's all right. Yeah. You know,
in kind of thinking about type 2 and other types of diabetes, because I'm sure there are other instances where insulin isn't appropriate, how would, if we're excluding insulin at the moment, let's say, what other medications are kind of used to help manage type 2?
There's a whole bundle of them. Literally, it's a whole bundle of them.
Yeah.
You've got Trulicity, I think, which Helga told you before. There's metformin, this, I can't remember all the names. And then you've got the GLP-1s and SGLT2s and the Mounjaro and Ozempic, which are either or of these other ones that I've just said, which are tending to be more to lose weight, which actually helps you to lose fat around the various organs, which helps to stop the insulin resistance. But it's, you know, if you really want to know, you go to a nice NG18, I think NG17's type 1, and NG18 is type 2, and it shows you the progress that they have, the GPs have to go through before you even get to insulin.
Yeah.
And the thing about insulin is that they tend, and it's they use it as a threat. If you don't behave yourself, I'm going to put you on insulin. They have no idea what the person's going through, what they're doing, and how they're doing it. But because their HbA1c is not as good as it should be, I'm going to put you on insulin. Is that the right way to do medication?
And having, you know, having experienced kind of that through dad DKI'd one, and the first thing they did when he went in, you know, was stick him on insulin after years of being on metformin and struggling, and it was a very emotional thing for him. You know, all of a sudden he was at 84 years of age, he was expected to inject, and there was no, the, you know, it did seem to be a particularly kind of like, that's it, that's what you're going to do, without any form of kind of interaction or education. It was, and it's funny you mentioned that, Ken, like it was used as a, you know, like it was used as a punishment. I got the feeling like that. It wasn't a proactive, this will make things better for you. It was more of a, oh God, well, we can't get you under control. So, and that's an interesting to hear you say that about about insulin with type 2s.
I mean, there's various insulin nowadays where you only inject once a week, and you've also obviously got ones that you fast as well. But your bolus and ballast and whatever, I never understand them. And I've been with doing it for the last 25 years. But it's getting things in a way that we can all understand, that we can all help one another with, and be our own advocate, because we're doing it for 365 days a year, as we all know, 24 hours. We see our healthcare professionals for a blip in that time. They need to understand what's going on. And if I take an extreme example, in a sense that people that want to try and get their HbA1c way, way down, if they know quite in advance of when their next appointment with the GP is, they could actually fix it so that their HbA1c was good, because they only measured the last 3 months. What are they doing for the next 9 months? How's that going? And this is where, in a sense, the technology needs to come into play. I think Partha Kark asked at the ATTD conference, everybody with type 1 should get all the various tech, everybody with type 2 tech, and everybody put their hands up, and then they said, how are you going to do it? And I asked the question, why is it even a question? And Partha, and he's right in a sense, where's the data? Where's the scientific proof that it actually works and helps people with type 2?
It would have been interesting to be in the room. I was only there watching that part kind of virtually.
Yeah.
But the impression was that when he'd said, how many people in the room think it's going to happen for those with type 2 in relation to the tech, I'm guessing no one put their hand up.
Yeah.
And it's just like, why?
Money, basically.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's false economy. Because, if you can save money on heart problems, limbs, etc., then, everything else. I see Helga's come back. I don't know if she's still around. Could you speak?
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
I've been holding the course. It's over to you now.
No, I thought you guys muted me. You had a secret mute button. And
no.
I got banished. I got banished, never to return.
It's
interesting that you speak. I've been able to hear everything, but obviously not being able to contribute. But we're talking about medication, so Trulicity, Ozempic, and I believe it's a worldwide issue at the moment, but certainly in South Africa, things like it's called Sebete, Trulicity, Ozempic. All of these medications are in short supply or cannot be obtained, and a lot of it is being prescribed for weight loss. And so, as a result, is even if your endocrinologist is prescribing. And remember, just so that I qualify that, Ozempic, Trulicity, etc., is exceptionally expensive in South Africa. And so for a month's supply of Trulicity, it costs 1,400 rand. It is not on the formulary on your medical aid. And so you have to pay cash for that. And 10 out of 10 people can't afford those Ozempic, can't afford the Trulicity. And so this is now being used, particularly around weight loss. And so I was prescribed it for my type 2 diabetes, not for weight loss, actually. And so now you've got a shortage of these medications. But my understanding is it's worldwide. It's not just in South Africa. And it's interesting enough, because I had a cousin here from Canada who has just been put onto Ozempic. And so he's on Ozempic now, and he's able to get it quite readily, and not at the cost that I'm paying for Trulicity here in South Africa. Ozempic's slightly cheaper, but again, you know, and I've also heard of some people buying it on the black market now, which is dangerous, you know. And so, you know, I just wonder around alternatives, and I wonder around accessibility around these treatments, particularly. But I was just, you know, just in terms of adding to the conversation around Trulicity, Ozempic, Bayeti, and all these alternatives, which aren't accessible for most people, certainly not in South Africa.
Very shortly. Okay. Thank you. Yeah, I'm going to have to leave, unfortunately, because I am in a ward. And they do need to do various observations and various other things. So if anyone wants to chat, I'm quite happy to chat later on Twitter and Facebook and everything else. And I think that's out there somewhere. So I'm going to have to leave you, I'm afraid.
Brilliant. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Ken.
Yeah, okay. Great. Have a good evening. Helga, it's over to you.
I don't know. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Kez, Tony, I am listening in. And what a fantastic chat. I think that's been really cool. I've just been packing my bag for work tomorrow. That was really, really empowering. Philip has been tweeting along. So people, please go check that out, because it's been a real opener tonight. And when I hear Helga and Ken talk, I get so inspired. And I remember going to ATCD, no, I'm sorry, ESAD last year. And I met Ken, and I came back with so much awareness about different types of diabetes. And I set up diabetes chat initially, I guess type one, but it really grew. Like, it was all types of diabetes, very inclusive, including parents, caregivers, and all types of diabetes. And I think it's really important we've done tonight's chat, and I think we need to do more. And I think Helga and Ken, now Ken's gone, I think we should pause part one, and I think we should come back in a few months' time, and we'll talk offline, and I think we should book in another chat, because there is so much yet to come. Do you reckon, Kez, Tony? What do you reckon?
Oh, I think there's, you know, the fact that we've spent the past hour and a half just being, you know, overwhelmed with such knowledge, and for me, education. It's and again, it's just, you know, it's nice to have those conversations about the diabetes community rather than the type 1 community or the type 2 community. You know, our similarities are greater than our differences, and you know, particularly a lot of what Ken said was really quite, you know, really quite insightful. Definitely, it's been fantastic. Just a proper education.
100%. Kez, I've just seen your tweet. Do you want to ask that final question to Helga, and we'll pause for part one? And Helga, would you come back? Would you come back to Diabetes Chat? We can connect up, and we can do a part two, because there's so much to talk about.
Yeah, I think it is. You know, and you know, we know that the movement of hashtag language matters. I'm trying to flip through the tweets, and as I'm going, I see Flipper, and I know there was a comment about, you know, in Canada that people don't really care. And I would love to come back to answer the question. But again, you know, around our language, around discrimination, around what we can practically do to expand the possibility of bringing more type 2 people into community. And I specifically say into community because that's what it is. And what the objective of that is. And it's again to be having these conversations to be able to be feeling inclusive and to get the support that is required. Yes, so I'd love to come back. And I'd love to offline in terms of discussing ideas, you know, some ideation around, you know, what can, I've got a couple of ideas around what that might look like. Because I think that, you know, sometimes we become a bit insular and we sit in our own bubble around what that is. And so I know that there's a lot of curiosity around, so how have you navigated your way into an international community as a type 2, as someone living with type 2 diabetes? And I think it's because I made the decision that diabetes is part of who I am. You know, it doesn't live alongside me any longer. And I think that, you know, if more people understand that, and even the lived experience of type 1, and in terms of engaging, I would love to see that there is a greater type 2 community that engages on these forums, because I think it can only enhance the work that's been done.
I think that's definitely something that we, particularly the diabetes chat team, that's something that we can aspire to, you know, aspire to get involved in particularly, you know, so maybe, maybe Tom and the team can kind of, and yourself, Helga, can, and possibly Ken, can kind of start to come together and kind of make the team bigger.
Yeah, like this, what's that? Make the circle bigger. Yeah.
Yeah.
Would be great.